Yes, thanks very much indeed, Sean. And looking around this hall from my vantage point, it does have the feel of a huge, many-layered basilica, which makes it an entirely appropriate and imaginative venue for tonight's penultimate BBC Prom of the 2010 season. Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall for a 400th anniversary performance of Monteverdi's Vespers, conducted by a man to whom this music could hardly mean more, Sir John Eliot Gardner. He first heard a performance of the Vespers when he was about 11, and that memory wouldn't let go of him. So much so that he determined to mount his own version of what he thought the work should sound like while he was still an undergraduate at Cambridge. He did so, and for that occasion, 46 years ago, he founded the Monteverdi Choir. They're here this evening, as is the orchestra John Eliot started later on, the English Baroque Soloists. Also taking part, His Majesty's Sackbuts and Cornets, and the London Oratory Junior Choir and the Schola Cantorum of the Cardinal Vaughan Memorial School. John Eliot's thought a lot about how to use this hall to give the music all its spatial characteristics, and what he's come up with means solo voices, children's choirs and instruments all doing a lot of travelling up to various points high in the dome. And at the very beginning, the divided Monteverdi choir makes its way down the steps of the auditorium onto the platform, each half headed by two chitarroni, those extravagant-looking long-necked lutes. The music we hear at the start of the Vespers of the Blessed Virgin is that with which Monteverdi had opened his opera Orfeo. And John Eliot Gardner is in no doubt that in the Vespers, Monteverdi is fusing opera and church ritual in music of intense and dramatic contrast, from the religious blood and thunder of the Dixit Dominus to the intimate eroticism of the psalm settings from the Song of Solomon, Nigra Sum and Pulchra Es. John Eliot says it's music ideally suited to the most operatic of Italian cities.
If one thinks of it as a Venetian-inspired, if not actually realised, piece, that's the place in Italy where there was the most sumptuous tradition of ceremonial music, with a doge circling the Piazza San Marco and then entering his own private chapel, the Basilica, and all this tremendous sort of panoply of costumes and silver trumpets and flunkies of one sort or another, and this terrific sense of occasion and of opulence. And that seems to me inherent in the music itself, so that one gets transported from a church service into something that is, I don't know, almost para-religious in a way. I mean, to me, there's so many elements of Turkish Islamic music, Arabic music, in the way that the tenors have their fioritura written out for them, in the way that the cornetti have this extraordinary ornamentation, which can be traced back to music that arrived in Venice thanks to the trade connections with Constantinople and so on. And to me, the ending of the piece with the Gloria with the two tenors is almost like two muezzins singing at the top of a minaret, greeting the dawn. And I feel that's what gives the whole piece an extra currency, an extra vibrancy, the fact that it's not boring church music. It's got something that surpasses all that. It's theatre, it's part Islamic, it's part Christian, it's glorious, and it fills space in the most intelligent and miraculous way.
And of course he was still working at the Mantuan Court when he wrote it,
yeah,
but very unhappy there really, and looking for new fields of endeavour. You kind of feel that, well, there wasn't actually a vacancy of course at Venice at the time, but it's you know, this is what I could do were I to get such a job.
Absolutely, that's exactly how I see it. It's a portfolio, it's a sort of CV, and he's cunningly directing it in two or three different directions at once. He's directing it towards Rome, particularly the Mass, which we're not performing tonight. Certainly the Vesper Psalms could have been performed in some of the richer churches there. It could easily have been an advertisement to the Duke of Mantua in saying, look, you passed me over once as the ducal organist, this is what I can do. And it certainly was an advertisement, you know, with a Venetian publisher and a Venetian setup and references to Venetian liturgy. Seems to me it's clearly a job application in its own way. Whether that actually meant that he performed it in its totality in Venice, we'll never know. It's likely that this was the music that he performed at his audition in 1613, and once he got the job, he was there for life, and the rest is history.
John Eliot Gardner, now all is ready on the platform. It's a wonderful sight. Two organs on each side, the brass in the middle. Children at the back, and the chitarroni making their way to the top of the steps as John Eliot Gardner appears on the platform here in the Royal Albert Hall to conduct Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610.
Two. Thank you. had pity. Surge amica, surge amica mea, amica mea, surge, surge, veni, veni, amiem transit, imbe abite, recessit, flores apparu erunt in terra nostra. Tempus mutationis. Thank you.
What Sir John Eliot Gardner in his programme note describes as unquestionably the most kaleidoscopic and opulent setting of the Magnificat that has come down to us in this period. The apotheosis of Monteverdi's mixture of old and new. Final section of Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610, given the 400th birthday performance here in the Royal Albert Hall on this penultimate night of the 2010 BBC Proms season. The soloists, all from the Monteverdi Choir, were Emanuela Galli and Lenita Ruiten, sopranos, Stephanie Guidera and Raffaele Pei, altos, Peter Doveran, Benjamin Clapham, Andrew Tortis, tenors, Tom Appleton, Alex Ashworth, Sam Evans and Jonathan Sells, bass. And they're all being brought individually to their feet by John Eliot Gardner. Members, as I say, of the Monteverdi Choir, the London Oratory Junior Choir, the Scholar Cantorum of the Cardinal Vaughan Memorial School, Chorus Master Charles Cole, His Majesty's Sackbuts and Cornets, and the English Baroque soloists Vida Carti Debreceni. The conductor, John Eliot Gardner. Well, if Monteverdi did direct that final Magnificat as part of his audition for the job at St. Mark's in Venice in 1613, as John Eliot suggests, there's no wonder he got the job. Simply magical here in the Royal Albert Hall, with those echoes, the cornets, the tenors, like muezzins greeting the dawn, as John Eliot says. And if it's Christian and Islamic religions meeting, how particularly appropriate at this time in September. John Eliot Gardner bringing everybody to their feet. The children, children's choirs back on the platform after their journey to the top of the building. And as for those two tenors, Peter Doveran and Andrew Tortis, they've been up and down several times. I should say the Monteverdi Choir runs this apprentice scheme now. Two alto soloists tonight, they were from it. And Stephanie Guidera, only 18. Vespers tour in celebration of its 400th anniversary. Well, 2 days ago they were all performing in the chapel at the Palace of Versailles. They're going on now to Bruges, to Pisa, where John Eliot has a festival. The audience will be welcomed by fanfares back and forth from the Leaning Tower to the Cathedral. Then they're in the Sheldonian, Oxford and Durham Cathedral. All the soloists, the vocal soloists, being brought once more to their feet. After this, John Eliot goes to Prague to conduct a concert in memoriam for Sir Charles Mackerras with the Czech Philharmonic, Smetana, Dvořák, Suk, and the closing scene of Janáček's Cunning Little Vixen, that great other affirmation of life which Sir Charles, like Janáček, wanted at his funeral. Well, tomorrow evening at 7:30, live here on Radio 3, we reach Prom 76, the last night of the Proms of this 2010 season. Quite some celebration as usual. BBC Singers, BBC Symphony Chorus, BBC Symphony Orchestra, all conducted by Jiří Bělohlávek. The soloists are starred. The violist Maxim Rysunov plays his version of Tchaikovsky's Rokoko Variations. And the ultimate luxury voice soprano, Renée Fleming, sings Smetana, Dvořák, Richard Strauss and Rodgers and Hammerstein. One last musical bash for the Proms 2010. But the audience here in the Royal Albert Hall tonight have witnessed quite some celebration of the power of music, courtesy of the man who composed it exactly 400 years ago, Claudio Monteverdi. For now, time for me to hand you on to John Shea at Broadcasting House to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Thank you to Martin Handley at the Royal Albert Hall. And as ever, you can listen again to this evening's concert anytime you like over the next 7 days by going to the Radio 3 website and following the Listen Again link. Well, next this evening is our feature, A.L. Kennedy, looking at the work and legacy of the Glasgow Boys, Scotland's first modern artists. That's in just under a quarter of an hour from now at 9:30. Then we've music from the jazz trumpeter Tom Arthurs, a member of Radio 3's New Generation Artists. That's at 10:15. The essay at 11 o'clock concludes this week's series on land and sea and sky. And then there's music from across the globe as Marianne Kennedy presents World on 3 at 11:15 tonight. So before our feature at 9:30, organ music by an Italian composer who's not nearly as prominent or well-known now as he was in his lifetime. He's Marco Enrico Bossi, a contemporary and friend of Puccini. In his youth, he was the organist at Como Cathedral, but after that he survived as that rare thing in the Italy of the period, a freelance concert organist. Well, Bossi composed prolifically for the instrument, and these are two of a set of five character pieces, Ora Mystica and Ora Gaudiosa. They're played by Pier Damiano Peretti. 2 of a set of 5 characteristic pieces by Marco Enrico Bossi, Ora Mystica and Ora Gaudiosa. Pier Damiano Peretti was the organist on that Naxos recording, and he was playing on the organ of Verden Cathedral in Germany. This is BBC Radio 3. It's now coming up to 28 minutes to 10, and time for this evening's feature. The Glasgow-based writer and comedian A.L. Kennedy has long had a fascination with her home city's enduring creative spirit. Well, now we've another chance to hear her exploration of the work of a group of rebellious Scottish painters known as the Glasgow Boys. During the 1880s, their determination and modernity caused a sensation, catapulting them onto the international art stage and placing Glasgow on the map for generations of artists to follow.
At one edge of the Knitts Hill estate stands the Glasgow Museum Resource Centre, a large, very clean and futuristic building, part industrial unit, part aircraft hangar, part art hospital. Inside, in a kind of suspended animation, rests a fraction of Glasgow's art, its vast inheritance of publicly owned beauty, including thousands of paintings that sleep, neatly unobserved, in row upon row of sliding racks, conjuring long perspectives in vast concrete-floored and shiny-ducted climate-controlled rooms. Here, hanging amongst centuries of creativity from all over the world, are the paintings of the Glasgow Boys, arguably Scotland's most important painters, men who blazed a trail for generations of European and Scottish artists.
Within a period of 15 years, less than a generation, the Glasgow Boys transformed Scottish painting.
Glasgow constantly has to try and is constantly proving itself like a sort of younger child. Edinburgh feels almost, you know, complacent and reasonably smug at times.
They were recognised as being the most significant group of artists working in Britain at the time. Some of the pictures in the exhibition, for example, the one that's coming to us from Ghent, it was shown at a salon in Ghent so that young Belgian artists could emulate this new style that had come out of Glasgow.
We're exploring what we thought was missing in Scottish painting. Then one day I think we found out about the Glasgow Boys, and it was the Highland Funeral, and it just seemed to be one of those paintings that if we were ever going to do anything, we had to follow. That was the lead.
That was quite a surreal moment, actually. Just slid out like a Henry and a lever and just bump. Incredible.
This is a gallery landscape by Henry.
Gene Walsh, senior curator at Kelvin Grove Gallery, slides out a rack of jaw-dropping later works. George Henry's dominant, almost looming Galloway landscape, painted in 1889. A dark, crouching goblin by E.A. Hornell. One of John Lavery's mistily atmospheric paintings of the Glasgow exhibition. And the truly startling, truly beautiful A Hind's Daughter by James Guthrie. With such a variety of subject and style, one has to ask, what makes a Glasgow boy?
They do have a love of landscape. They like single-figure subjects. They shied away from anything that was sentimental or historical or dramatic. Their pictures are all mainly everyday people working in the fields or, as I say, a straightforward landscape.
I find it interesting that they're choosing to paint people that aren't heroic and that aren't famous and that aren't wealthy. Not that they're, you know, capital R radical, but I mean, where would you put them?
I think for the Glasgow Boys, they more or less wanted to make a social comment just on what they saw, but you're not supposed to feel sorry for these people or, angry. I get angry against, the landlords that own the land that they work on. Very few pictures show the city of Glasgow. They all had studios in the city, but part of the raison d'etre of the Glasgow Boys was painting out of doors.
The Glasgow Boys weren't a movement as such. In fact, they were almost defined by a fluidity of approaches and relationships. What did unite them was a tenacious spirit, a sharing of imaginative energy that expressed another Glasgow, not just the grinding industrial metropolis, the dirty, dodgy, non-capital city, but somewhere that was moved by global inspirations, charged with stylistic experiment and passion.
If you were to list all of the Glasgow Boys, you could probably include as many as 24 in the group. But it was always a very loose-knit group, and I doubt that all 24 were ever in the same room at the same time together.
Roger Billcliffe runs a gallery in Glasgow and is author of the definitive biography of the Glasgow Boys.
What linked them all together was an interest in new ideas in painting. Whatever training they had was relatively traditional, but they realised that other things were happening outside Glasgow, outside Scotland, outside London even, that they were beginning to take note of, and they wanted to introduce these ideas into their own painting.
Deeper inside the Labyrinthine Resource Centre is a bright white upper room where conservators examine and tend to paintings. Leaning against the wall is a piece I've only ever seen in books, The Highland Funeral by James Guthrie. The key early canvas of a key Glasgow boy. In a way, it marked the start of an era.
This is a funeral that actually took place at Brigaturk when Guthrie and some of the other boys were there. It was 1882.
I'm with Hugh Stevenson, curator of British art at Kelvin Grove.
Tragically, a local boy had just got drowned in the river, and so they held his funeral, and as you see, it was held outside the cottage, and only men went to funerals in those days, no women present. I think that's the minister on the left with his hand raised in some sort of blessing, and the dead boy's little brother is obviously standing beside the funeral. Father is there, and other villagers.
It's an ambitiously large canvas in muted greys and fawns, gently imbued with a kind of stricken stillness, the dignified and muted pain of a child's funeral. Guthrie was only 22 when he painted it.
There's not overt emotion, really. It's quite quiet emotion. I think that the old man on the right there with the stooped stance and red cheeks, obviously very sad, but it's not over the top at all. The gesture of the man beside him holding his cap in his hand, you can see there's some sort of emotion in the way he's grabbing hold of his cap, I think.
He's got that grey, drained-looking face of sort of real grief.
Yes, well, of course, the service is taking place maybe in the melting snow, and it's all very grey and black. There's not much colour at all. Very appropriate, of course, for a sad event like this.
Guthrie was embracing the spirit of his time, committing himself to portray a truth, to capture a subject's inherent qualities without heavy moral illusions or sentimentality. He was more than ready to follow the charismatic James McNeill Whistler's lead and produce art which felt no obligation to convey an edifying message. Whistler, an American-born but British-based painter, rose to prominence in the 1860s and inspired hundreds of painters to produce art for art's sake. He crystallised his views in his 10 o'clock lecture. The boys loved it.
And when the evening mist clothes the riverside with poetry, and the poor buildings lose themselves in the dim sky, and the warehouses are palaces in the night, then the wayfarer hastens home. The working man and the cultured one cease to understand, as they have ceased to see. And nature, who for once has sung in tune, sings her exquisite song to the artist alone.
So Guthrie rejects the high drama, the stags and plaids and gushing emotion of paintings popular earlier in his century. He is not moved by Queen Victoria's newfound love of the Highlands to produce idealised and politely unpeopled landscapes. The boys came to resent painters who did. Roger Billcliffe.
The boys called these painters the gluepots. They painted terrible paintings, really, sort of Highland vistas, the poor but honest working classes in various sentimental scenes, historical costume pieces. To give these pictures kind of instant age, to give them a sort of instant respectability, these grand academicians painted them using a brown medium called McGilp, which made them look immediately like old masters. The only way you can get it fluid is to heat it, like horse glue. And so the boys call the people who used it gluepots.
In 1877, the gluepots snubbed a number of soon-to-be Glasgow boys, James Guthrie among them, by refusing them membership to the Glasgow Arts Club. This is perhaps not surprising. Guthrie's Highland Funeral has much more in common with The Burial at Ornon, painted in 1849 by the radical French realist Gustave Courbet, than any gluepot. young boys were fascinated by new developments in painting from France. And innovative descriptions of French rural life were to galvanise their development. Inspiration didn't come so much from Courbet as one of his disciples, the painter Jules-Bastien Lepage, whose sensibility and subject matter enthralled them. After several exhibitions in London, Lepage would ultimately show at the Glasgow Institute of Fine Arts in 1883.
Bastien Lepage went through the traditional French training of studying at the École des Beaux-Arts. He was the star student. He was expected to win all of the prizes, but he fell at the last hurdle and did not win the Prix de Rome. And he retired almost at the age of 21 to his home village of Damvillers, and he set himself the task of painting the life of the village. And, you know, he more or less said, just as there's a village farrier and a village grocer and so on, I'm the village artist. His style combined an appreciation of light, in the same way that the Impressionists began to perceive light, with academic techniques.
Lepage's Parmèche, which means nothing doing, is one of his most influential works. It's a full-length portrait of a scruffy, poor, but entirely self-assured village boy. He stands in the centre of the canvas, at ease, and looks the observer right in the eye. If it wasn't for Lepage's signature, it could be by a Glasgow boy.
They often have a similar format. The figure is placed right at the front of the plane of the canvas. They're almost standing on the picture frame. They fill the sort of whole canvas. The horizon is, if there's a horizon at all, it's very high, and their heads are usually silhouetted against it to emphasise the focus of the picture.
James Guthrie painted A Hind's Daughter in 1883, and it echoes many of the characteristics that Roger describes. Here, the figure of a little girl stands, four square, in a plot of cabbages, as if she has just paused in her work. Behind her are a barn, a high horizon, a pale sky. Like the boy in Parmèche, she meets your eye, almost challenges your need to look. She is not pretty, demands no sympathy, but she is intensely beautiful, deeply alive. Guthrie painted this in the village of Coburn's Path on the east coast, one of the rural locations the Glasgow boys chose for its beautiful light. Jean Walsh.
In the summer months, they would pack up all their artist kit and equipment and try and find kind of isolated places, mainly in the lowland areas of Scotland, like Coburn's Path, Brigaturk or Crail, mainly the sort of east coast, where the light was different. They had a beautiful light which they could capture and would paint together out of doors. And it was very important that they worked as a group, because they then had this cross-fertilisation of ideas, and they would comment on each other's pictures and encourage each other.
This relocation as a kind of artisan in a rural community was in the spirit of French painters. Camille Corot and Jean-François Millet, among others, had set the trend at the Barbizon School. But it was the village of Grez-sur-Loing on the Seine near Fontainebleau that drew the next generations of artists.
It's an unspoilt village, a strange village that only exists on one side of the river. And yet it has this wonderful bridge connecting it to the other side, but there's nothing on the other side of the river. Nobody lives on the other side of the river. It's just almost sort of fête champêtre, really, that the villagers used and still use for leisure pursuits. One of the sort of peripheral Glasgow boys, Arthur Melville, had been to Grez in the late 1870s. Robert Louis Stevenson visited Grez. Alfred Delius lived in Grez. A lot of Scandinavian painters, American painters, French painters naturally, and even Japanese artists went to Grez. And they went there partly because of the sort of bohemian atmosphere and the vitality of this small village with all of these quite advanced artists working together, but also because of its peculiar light and the way the light was reflected off the slow-running river that went through it.
Of all the Glasgow boys, John Lavery drew the most inspiration from Grez-sur-Loing. Originally from Belfast, Lavery enrolled at the Glasgow School of Art in 1876, but it was at Grez that he really found his artistic milieu. The tranquil waters, the clear light, and the artist's community became vital resources. A slow-moving rowing boat, a woman carrying food in a basket, girls lying in grass by the river. Other members of the group found rural communities closer to home, in villages such as Coburn's Path, Cucubri and the Borders, and Brigatark, which was only 30 miles from Glasgow. What has been happening with this picture? With me in the bright white room is conservator Polly Smith, who is working on a small painting of Brigatark by George Henry.
This painting is a small landscape with a central figure moving away into the distance along the path. The original colours, as you see, are all very muted sort of earth tones. And when that had a varnish layer on that had discoloured to a very, very deep yellow, the whole thing becomes a rather even tone. So you lose the sense of three-dimensionality. And as this has come off, it's revealed much more contrast between that sky and the darker foreground. And now you can see a much wider range of those beautiful greens and earth tones.
It's a wonderful room to be in just before the exhibition opens. Beside Polly's easel is one of my favourite paintings, again by John Guthrie, the portrait of a village worthy from Cucubri called Woolley.
I love the attitude of a lot of Guthrie's portraits, just the way that the person is just there. And he's not necessarily a man of dignity and wealth, but there's always a sense of like, well, you can paint me if you want, I'm not quite sure why, but here I am.
It's a picture that is much loved by Kelvin Grove visitors, yeah, because it has this sense of a real person, you know, or somebody's granddad, or someone who's quite reliable. And Guthrie doesn't shirk from showing the wrinkles and the long sideboards and the kind of weather-beaten face.
Although the boys sought out the weather-beaten faces of rural workers, the industrial labourers of their home city were almost entirely ignored. Ironically, the Glasgow boys rarely painted Glasgow, largely preferring subjects far from the grind and filth of manufacture.
It was at the peak of industrialisation and the peak of change, the Victorian times. So we're going to walk down this lane, and this takes us on to Glasgow Cross, which is the oldest part of Glasgow. On the other side of Glasgow,
a tour of Glasgow only highlights the contrast between the Glasgow boys' rural scenes and the city's noise and smoky breath. Patricia Clark runs Greetin' Glasgow Tours.
There was carpet factories, there was steelmaking industry, where there was glassware made, tradesmen that did the sandstone work. So at its peak, a massive population.
Half the world's railway locomotives were built in Glasgow in 1890.
Roger Billcliffe.
Two-thirds of the world's shipping had been built on the Clyde. The Japanese Navy was built on the Clyde. The Russian imperial yachts were built on the Clyde. We tend to think these days of the big liners like the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth built at John Brown's in Clyde Bank. But there were shipyards the full length of the Clyde. Everybody came to Scotland to buy their ships.
Glasgow saw itself as the world's workshop, triumphant, innovative. But the shock of the city's transformation must have been intense. It didn't attract the boys, or Charles Rennie Mackintosh, designer, architect and painter, who also lived in the city, but drew his inspiration from delicate natural forms. Irises, tulips, leaves. The Willow Tea Rooms on Socky Hall Street, based on Mackintosh's original designs, still provide a sense of considered beauty and peace in the heart of the city. Stuart Robertson runs the Rennie Mackintosh Society.
You're in the last major tea room that Mackintosh designed, where Mackintosh was given complete freedom of design, and he's created these fantasies aspects where you've got the Salon Deluxe, where you've got all the lovely glass around the perimeter, which is creating this reflections, and so you were in a wood, and you've got this lovely chairs, which are silver, creating this sort of silver, the willow and aspects. So you've got this pure nature where Mackintosh has evolved, you know, a place where people can feel comfortable, they're in an oasis.
50 years later, the grand ruins of this once overwhelming industry have become part of the artistic and cultural life of Glasgow.
I began to feel that there was something missing. And I suddenly realised that what I found missing in Ridley was the fact that everything there was only 2 or 3 years older than I was.
Alistair Gray, author of, among other things, the novel Lanark, grew up in Ridgery to the north of the city centre. For him, the energy and scale of Glasgow's industrial past was both a revelation and a source of strength. Discovering the majesty of the old canal system formed a turning point for him as a young boy, a boy who would become an artist and a writer.
In Lanarkshire, you'd great beds of coal and also beds of iron, which, before the invention of railways, right the canal system. And the canal system had to descend steeply through Ridgery along one side through a series of gigantic canal locks. Mm-hmm. When the railway trains started in, the canal company, trying to compete, arranged possibly the biggest system of locks in Britain, in which you had 3 very big basins at different levels with a double system of locks so that you could have barges going up,
all up and down, right,
and down, yes, simultaneously without getting in each other's way. They were really vast, and their impression on me was, I think, very much if, let's say, a child had grown up in a modern municipal housing estate, shall we say, at the edge of Rome, and then exploring had suddenly come across the Colosseum,
right,
or one of the gigantic Roman aqueducts, the feeling of, did other people do that?
I belong to Glasgow, dear old Glasgow town. But there's something the matter with Glasgow, for it's going round and round. I'm only a common old working lad, as anyone can see. But when I get a couple of drinks on a Saturday, Glasgow belongs to me.
And when I was about to become a young writer, I read Alistair's work and found that same sense of awe and excitement and potential underlying his work. Like any good artist, he found something wonderful, distilled it, and passed it on. Alistair gave me one of my first introductions to the restless, monstrous, wonderful city where I now live. His book, Lanark, tasted of the Glasgow I was already growing to love, the place where comics came from, disreputable songs, the Red Clydesiders who left for Westminster with hymns sung on the railway platform to wish them well, the Glasgow of mass recruitment and mass casualties, of casual violence and heartbreaking generosity. And he caught the spirit of an ingenious population, largely not wealthy, often not even comfortable, but with an access to dignity. A history of achievements in the mysteries of demanding crafts. Glasgow was a city of artisans who mastered machines that could kill them, who conjured up engines, harnessed powers, transformed materials, created ocean liners bigger than the tenements they could be glimpsed through as they grew. When I moved to Glasgow, all around me were still physical proofs of what extraordinary things, ordinary, extraordinary human beings can achieve.
The streets are all named after the tobacco lords. Buchanan Street, we've got Ingram Street, we've got Glasford Street. The Gallery of Modern Art is an example of the grandeur of the buildings in Glasgow. At the time when it was a mansion, the tobacco lords really did make millions for Glasgow.
Although our painters weren't interested in urban life as subject matter, their reputation had in fact been nurtured by the explosion of industry which created ideal economic conditions for art to flourish. Glasgow had money. Its industry gave rise to an extraordinary group of new patrons who were among the first collectors of the boy's work.
People like the Reeds, who ran North British Locomotive Factory, people forget that the tenants' wealth comes from bleach in Glasgow.
There was Robert Napier, Archibald MacLean, William Allen Coates, and the preeminent Sir William Burrell, whose vast bequest to the city in 1944 was made up of a staggering 9,000 works, including paintings by many of the Glasgow boys.
There's the horn, Jack! A Cadena Blooming Horn!
Burrell was a ship owner as opposed to a shipbuilder. Burrell was very crafty. He bought fleets of ships during depressions when prices were cheap. He ran them, And as the prices went up, he would sell them off. He'd sit back for a few years, wait for another depression, and go and buy another fleet of ships. Burrell was acquisitive. He had a wonderful eye. He had a huge purse, but nobody was quite like him.
Guiding these wealthy collectors was influential Scottish dealer Alexander Reed. He helped shape collections of new work from European artists and pioneered British interest in the work of Van Gogh. Van Gogh even painted his portrait. Glasgow soon rose to prominence not just for its industrial muscle, but for its pursuit of the modern and adventurous in painting, and Reed cultivated buyers' interest in the city's artists. And he was willing to invest in them himself. In 1893, he helped finance a research visit to Japan by Hornell and Henry. Painted 4 years prior to this trip, George Henry's Galloway landscape is bold, energetic, compared to his earlier subdued painting of Brigger Turk. Jean Walsh.
So this particular picture by Henry, it's quite a mundane scene. It's basically cows in a field, but he transforms this into this, you know, the winding, snaking stream, which is a really dark, dark blue, not like what you'd see in reality. And he kind of tips up, flattens the perspective so that you get the top of the hill almost comes up to
you, yeah.
Almost falling on you. So it has a strange, eerie quality to it.
Paintings like this thrilled collectors, eager to keep pace with the latest fashions. As ever, when it came to embracing new tastes, the critics often lagged behind.
They did get some very bad reviews, particularly A Galloway Landscape, because people just didn't understand it at all. They thought, got it all wrong. These people don't know how to paint. If they did eventually get their pictures accepted for exhibition, sometimes they were skied. And what I mean by that is they were hung up really, really high so that it was very difficult for people to see their pictures.
Glasgow's internationally aware art scene was incredibly fertile and began to challenge Scotland's traditional cultural centre. Edinburgh. Michael Fry is a historian and author of A New History of Edinburgh.
Glasgow spawned what Edinburgh could not spawn. That was tycoons, people of vast wealth who built enormous mansions and ran fleets of steamships and oppressed their workers. And of course, these people were nouveau riche. They were upstarts. You know, I would concede that Edinburgh probably resented the rapid rise of Glasgow to greater importance and greater wealth.
And there lies the, to be honest, slightly tedious, age-old tension between Scotland's two major cities. Michael and I are standing in Edinburgh on the customary viewpoint, the top of Calton Hill. Below us lies the city, layer upon layer of buildings that form dark chasms and grey spires, all curried in between the show-off mountains and the icy glimmer of salt water.
The history in the 19th century was very different because Edinburgh never really had an industrial revolution. There are no coal mines or steelworks around here. I mean, the main industries in Edinburgh were publishing and brewing. So it never acquired that kind of smoky, Dickensian, Victorian air about it. And it never acquired militant trade unionism. Unlike in Glasgow, you never had class warfare between huge, you know, cigar-smoking capitalists and downtrodden workers. And I think that's made a huge difference to the life of the city.
But there is that slight sense that the new town was an attempt to get away from the really horrible poor people that you couldn't employ. I mean, basically, there wasn't a class war because it had been won.
It was also segregated, of course. I mean, Scottish history is a dark, violent, bloody history. And by the 18th century, they really wanted to put all that behind them. So they created a kind of heavenly city, as Robert Louis Stevenson called it. Everything was regular and ordered and civilised. The barbarism of the Scottish past was being left behind. Or so they thought, so they thought. And Robert Louis Stevenson knew better, of course. I mean, he...
The man of Jekyll and Hyde, and this is the city of Jekyll and Hyde, yeah. Whenever I read Jekyll and Hyde, obviously it is set in London, but clearly, it just isn't. It's like a cross between Gormenghast. It's this kind of ornate, layered, over-layered built-up city full of, yeah, strange, curious people with dark activities, and then this enormous division, which is such a hugely Scottish thing. I just find it, you know, it's very psychologically complicated. It's the city I wouldn't want to go out with, because it might be quite charming and glamorous at the beginning, but at the end you'd find out
that it'll strangle you. Yes, I agree. And I think Robert Louis Stevens really captured the essence of the city beautifully. People who don't come from Edinburgh, especially Glaswegians, say, Edinburgh, or even Londonians say it as well, Edinburgh, they're so snooty, you know, they're all stuck up.
As we drove in, the flag is on the flagpole at Holyrood Palace, so some kind of royal presence is in residence. Obviously, there's a much stronger royal connection with Edinburgh. Glasgow's the more left-wing, the more Republican city. I mean, how do you think that manifests itself?
Well, I think because Edinburgh is very conscious of being the ancient capital of Scotland. And when Scotland lost its independence in 1707 and Edinburgh lost its status as capital, it was very intent on maintaining the symbols that reminded it of its former status. At the times when royalty deigned, or started deigning, to come and visit Edinburgh again, Edinburgh was obviously very pleased. I mean, when Bonnie Prince Charlie came here in 1745, he was very heartily, if somewhat hypocritically, welcomed.
I guess they're quite glad to say goodbye as well. They managed to be pleased about everything in the Scottish.
Glad he went away again. And then King George IV came on a famous visit in 1821.
Oh, in a kilt as well.
In a kilt. And then Queen Victoria started coming here and loved it. And now that we have the Scottish Parliament as well, I mean, things are almost complete.
Wandering Edinburgh today, you could believe that its creative dynamism has faded under the burdens of concentrated Scottishness. Pipers on autopilot every 10 yards, beach towels printed on like kilts, tartan hats with built-in ginger wigs. But in the Glasgow Boys' day, Edinburgh's cultural dominance was no laughing matter. Glasgow-based painters were virtually barred from acceptance in the capital and the credibility that would bring. Admission to the Royal Scottish Academy could seem frustratingly, absurdly impossible.
The Royal Scottish Academy did not admit members who did not live in Edinburgh. You might, if you were very grand, get away with living 30 miles outside the city, but you didn't get away with living in Glasgow. And, you know, the boys were quite bitter about it, and they would write polemics about these grand academicians with their studios in Queen Street and George Street, with no hope of anyone else getting to show in Edinburgh.
I'm just looking at an issue of The Bailey, 17th November 1880. A correspondent writes, "Unless an artist occupies a studio in George Street or Picardy Place, he need not hope to find any favour in the eyes of the Royal Scottish Academy. The authorities have done their best to discourage Glasgow art." Well then, today Bill Scott is the president of the Royal Scottish Academy.
I think that there was an issue just about the time that the Glasgow Boys came along, that there was quite a stuffy, settled atmosphere amongst the members of the Academy. And I think that the Glasgow Boys were seen as introducing new thinking and new ideas that conflicted with the current way of working in the Academy itself. And what was interesting for me was that the Glasgow Boys came out of an environment which was very industrial, very busy, very active, in comparison to the Edinburgh situation, which was very settled, an administrative capital, really, still.
My name is Sandy Moffat. I'm an old-fashioned painter. You know, if we're talking about the Academy, for example, everything's done in a studio, according to a certain theory, in a sense, you know, a classical theory, something that goes back to maybe even the Greeks and the Romans.
Sandy, a painter and former lecturer at Glasgow School of Art, is now head of exhibitions at the Academy. He's helping me approach the mindset of a proper Academy painter in the 1880s, still stuck in his studio far from reality, even though oil and tubes, which enabled artists to paint out of doors, had been invented 40 years before.
You're going to a field with your canvas, with your brushes, with your paint, and you're standing a few feet away from someone that's digging the field or whatever, planting seeds, then that's a completely different experience you're projecting onto your canvas. And I think that's what they did.
So you've kind of if you were an academy painter, you'd have lost control, you might get rained on, you couldn't fiddle the composition.
An academy painter, you wouldn't even think about doing that.
Right.
Here, because that idea of being close to your subject didn't even come into it. You know, the subject was what was something that was classically approved, first of all, and been handed down to you. It'd be something that could only be constructed in a studio, perhaps with the help of antique casts, all that kind of stuff, you know, and numerous compositional drawings, you know, all painstakingly mapped out before you could even think about starting the painting. But the Glasgow boys, they were into the field, the canvas, and they just made the painting. That's revolutionary. That's very, very different, yeah.
And kind of terrifying, I would imagine. I mean, exhilarating, but it's very sort of chaotic at a certain level.
It's chaotic, you're going to make a mess.
That freedom of expression which fired the Glasgow boys would still be there generations later for Sandy. The life of their art, ready to startle new observers, to spark new work.
I studied painting in Edinburgh, and John Bellany and I were students together, and we were exploring what we thought was missing in Scottish painting, because it seemed rather limited to still lifes and landscapes. You know, that was our point of view in the early 1960s. Then one day I think we found out about the Glasgow boys, or somebody mentioned the Glasgow boys. So they became quite mythic, and we jumped on the train. And it was the Highland Funeral in particular that we wanted to see, that we wanted to identify, because in that, in a sense, was the one great painting of Scottish, as it were, ordinary life. You could even say working-class life. And that was the one Scottish painting, too, that seemed to link us directly with, say, Gustav Kirby. So the Guthrie painting became hugely emblematic. And it just seemed to be one of those paintings that if we were ever going to do anything, we had to follow. That was the lead. That was the lead we needed, that Guthrie, the Scottish painter, had done that particular painting, the Highland Funeral, at that particular time. And that's so, so important, I think, when you're looking for a way of moving ahead.
The faces of farm workers in the boys' early paintings have a striking honesty. They seem to aim for a direct connection. But as their work gathered attention and their wealth grew, the boys turned towards their patrons, people who could buy their own portraits, usually rendered with appropriate restraint.
They kind of, I'm afraid, they become more bourgeois, don't they, as they become successful. I think by the 90s, for example, the mid-90s, they're unrecognisable as the Glasgow boys, as we know and love, as it were.
The person who was perhaps most interested in money was John Lavery. Lavery realised that if it was the middle classes who were buying the pictures, perhaps the middle classes would appreciate middle-class subjects. And his masterpiece, The Tennis Party, painted in 1885, shows a group of young men and women playing tennis in the garden of a house in Cathcart, just outside Glasgow, aimed fairly and squarely at a middle-class market.
Lavery's masterpiece is unexpected given the boy's roots. 3 years later, he took a royal commission. It assured his commercial future, but what about art for art's sake? Jean Walsh.
When Queen Victoria makes her state visit, he gets the commission to paint the commemorative picture.
Which is wonderful and yet horrifying.
Yeah. Lavery does individual sketches of all these people, you know, that are in the composition. So it's a huge, huge task. But Lavery's quite canny because he knows that he'll go on to be one of Britain's greatest portrait painters.
And he's met everybody who's anybody in the
who might want to commission a portrait from him.
Lavery lived to regret his abandonment of the boy's early principles. In his 1940 autobiography, he wrote, "I have felt ashamed of having spent my life trying to please sitters and make friends instead of telling the truth and making enemies." He wasn't alone. Having expended so much energy defying the elitism of the Royal Scottish Academy, James Guthrie would become its president, albeit quite a good one. By the turn of the century, the Radicals had become the new establishment and the boys had drifted apart. But before they went their separate ways, they sealed their reputation with a group show at London's Grosvenor Gallery in 1890.
The exhibition was visited by a couple of talent scouts, almost, from the Munich Academy. They saw the Grosvenor Gallery exhibition and took it, almost in its entirety, to Munich, where it was an immediate sensation. And they were chosen to represent British art in all of the sort of galleries in the Empire and the Dominions and the Commonwealth.
and Pittsburgh, Chicago, Venice, Vienna, Dusseldorf, Berlin, Moscow, St. Petersburg. Successful, mainstream, and out in the world, the group began to disperse through the late 1890s, but the legacy of their most creative period continued. Glasgow's artists were still at work. In 1897, work began on Glasgow's very own School of Art. It was designed with characteristic flair and harmonious detail by the genius Charles Rennie Mackintosh, designer, architect and painter, the one who liked leaves and flowers, you remember. The pioneering boys had prepared his way.
That would have been magical, to have these artists, to have the confidence to break loose.
Stuart Robertson.
It's interesting seeing Mackintosh's drawings. It would have been a different school if it had been built in the first phase. It shows you over that 10-year period, Mackintosh evolving and his creative flow and what he created in the whole aspect of that. But he also marries in elements with Japan, where you've got the railings, where he creates these sort of motifs that are relating. And again, a lot of these are animal and plant forms, so he plays in that game. So there's an awful lot within the building where he didn't have a big budget. He had to be quite creative. Mackintosh had a certain element, he was moving forward. And again, I suppose like any new person or new artist, if you're breaking new ground, you're generally appearing never accepted.
The school has sheltered and encouraged art students for over a century, and that Glasgow tradition of creativity and invention is still alive today.
How are you doing? Diane Hutchison. Oh, hiya. My name is Diane Hutchison. I'm a fourth-year paint and printmaking student at the Glasgow School of Art. There's an atmosphere and there's a vibe to the school, there's no question about it. It's kind of got its own history. It's got a reputation for producing some great students. You know, you're part of a fabric or something. You know, you're a layer. You're sort of contributing to it. It's contributing to you. We all have our own designated studio space and we're encouraged to use it as a laboratory like Dominic's doing behind me here. And basically, you just get the head down.
Francis McKee is director of Glasgow's Centre for Contemporary Art and teaches at the school.
It's a good place to study because the art school is very contemporary-minded. Unlike some other art schools that are still very classical, there's a real sort of diversity in Glasgow School of Art, and it acknowledges that, and it acknowledges the scene beyond the front door. So there's a sort of relationship between Glasgow School of Art and the community.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. It's a nice city. It's kind of, it's not too big, and it's just quite a friendly city. It's a little bit like community spirit, I suppose, that people do stick together a little bit, and it does have its rough patches and all of that, but that's what makes it kind of real in a way.
If you're a young artist, it is a great place to make a name for yourself very quickly, to get a profile, because it's so small, because there's so many opportunities to make something for yourself, that as soon as you do that, you actually begin to build a platform for yourself quite quickly. And if you went to London or Paris or New York, you'd be struggling in a very, very large city that didn't really want to know. Whereas here, it's a very small city where most people will turn up and give you a chance, and quickly you'll establish a reputation.
You come here, you're kind of told about the predecessors and how well they've done. So you're sort of like, oh, God. And then you hear that a lot of names repeated, which is great. You're sort of aware of that. But that just makes you, again, it's like another layer you're adding on to that. I think it's just a really good thing. I don't think it's going to go away now, that's for sure. I think it can only get stronger.
For me, Glasgow is still a city of pride and infernal sunsets, reckless imagination and perhaps quixotic, perhaps glorious endeavour. We can take our lead from the boys' slow fading into safety, respectable comfort and deuce wee interiors. But we can also choose to catch their fire, make our own creative discoveries and mistakes. And we can simply appreciate that peculiar generosity which leads some people to make unnecessary beauties and hand them on. In my adopted home, fewer ship's horns sound at New Year. There are fewer cranes, fewer pensioners now who taught themselves by reading their local library from A to Z, who embraced their duty to light their interior lives through unremitting days. But Glasgow remains somewhere which appreciates how hard-won beauty can be, and how sustaining in unforgivable times and lost places.
A.L. Kennedy celebrating the creative spirit of her home city. The Glasgow Boys was produced by Kate Bland and Paddy Langley and was a Just Radio production for BBC Radio 3. It was first broadcast in March this year. Well, on Monday evening, Nightwaves returns to Radio 3 following the proms, and in the first programme of its new season, Rana Mehta will be discussing the controversial legacy of Chairman Mao. The programme's theatre critic Susanna Clapp talks about forthcoming highlights from John Sims' Hamlet in Sheffield to Kim Cattrall's Cleopatra in Liverpool. There's a review of the first major exhibition in the recently reopened Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, the Pre-Raphaelites and Italy. And the Israeli writer David Grossman talks about his new novel, To the End of the Land, a story of an Israeli mother, her son, and the costs of war. That's all in Nightwaves on Monday evening at 9:15.
On BBC Radio 3, Afternoon on 3 presents the complete works of Gustav Mahler. To mark the 150th anniversary of the composer's birth, we'll be bringing you 5 weeks of Mahler between now and the end of the year, celebrating various facets of his life and work. To begin, we explore the fundamentally Mahlerian themes of love and death, with a week of music including proms performances from the season just past and an opera matinee, the very first stage performance Mahler ever conducted. Afternoon on 3 with the music of Mahler, composer, conductor. Weekday afternoons next week from 2 o'clock.
Land and sea and sky, that's been the theme of this week's Radio 3 essays. You can hear the last of those at 11 o'clock tonight. Then Mary Ann Kennedy is here at 11:15 with this week's World on 3. Now, though, with the time approaching 18 minutes past 10, we're going to hear from another of our Radio 3 New Generation artists. And tonight it's the turn of the trumpeter Tom Arthurs. He's the second jazz musician to take part in the scheme, following on from the pianist Gwilym Simcock. And Tom is no stranger to these airwaves. He's been nominated 3 times for the BBC Jazz Awards, and his recent commissions include a joint one from the BBC and the Royal Philharmonic Society for the City of London Festival. He made the recordings we're going to hear tonight last December with some of his regular collaborators. This first piece is called Scene One.
Thank you. Thank you.
Scene 1 by Tom Arthurs. Well, this next piece by him is called Castalia, and it features improvisation from his pianist, Benoit Delbecq.